When I say Amish, what do you think about? Horse and buggy? Rocking chairs? How about big-time oil and gas drilling? Well, today we visit the crossroads of the old world and new on the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Also, farm kids tell us what we should know about country life.
Be careful of the pigs because sometimes they can be very rough, and the chickens, they might peck you.
Plus, high school students go winter camping. All this and more is coming your way on the Allegheny Front. Please stay tuned. If you're listening to today's show on your iPhone, but also backing up some photos on your laptop, hold on, you may be redundant. That is, using extra energy. We've been reporting about the carbon footprint of our cyber world. The Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray speaks with an expert about what changes we all can make to reduce our carbon load.
So I'm here with Scott Matthews. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. What can individuals do to save energy as far as their cloud activities, their online activities?
So the main activity that a individual could probably do would be to, first of all, limit the number of devices in which they're trying to use these services. If you have 5 devices, but you really only use one that you're ever going to show other people pictures or try to look at contacts on, then that's probably the only one you need to have enabled to do those things, even though by default, the companies want you to turn it on all of your devices. And that's important because the energy use that's at the data center in the cloud is going to be used sort of no matter what. The impact that you can have is by not having that all of your devices are constantly syncing with those data centers and constantly updating and, you know, using, you know, wireless or Wi-Fi.
Can you give some examples of multiple devices that people constantly sync to the cloud?
Sure. So in our household, we have 2 iPads and 2 phones and 2 old iPhones that our kids use. We didn't realize until a month or so ago that the old iPhones that the kids now use were constantly syncing all of our stuff too. They could care less to look at their baby pictures when they're playing games, but we often use those to show friends and family. So we've turned it off on those 2 devices, and that's the same kind of thing that other households could do.
So basically the data is just being stored on the iPhone rather than being stored on the cloud and the iPhone.
Right.
So what would be the tipping point? Like, how many people would have to stop being redundant as far as storing things on physical devices and on the cloud? How many people would have to do that to actually make a difference?
Well, that's a good question. I think the important thing is that for the companies like Apple and Google and others that are promoting these cloud services, they're building data centers one at a time. And even though they might be building many of them over time, every time they're building one, they're anticipating that many users to sort of fill up its capacity. But we're talking probably hundreds of thousands of users per data center. So once a data center is built, they want to be able to use all of it until they need to build another one. So to some extent, you could think about the tipping point being at that scale. If we want to have a reduction in energy use in that way, you've got to be able to turn off a data center. Turning it half off doesn't really work. So you need lots and lots of users to decide or to not pursue those kinds of services if you really want to avoid impacts.
What is the rate that this is growing at? I know right now data centers consume 1-2% of the U.S. electricity usage and actually global electricity usage. What is the projected rate that scientists are seeing now as far as cloud energy usage?
Well, the cloud energy usage has actually been going down a little bit over the last 5 years, but that's mostly because the data centers, they've figured out how to make them more efficient. So 5 years ago or so, the electricity use from data centers was doubling every year, and now it's only going up by about half. Now, that's still a lot, but that means that they've really started to figure out how to pack lots and lots of servers and lots of users into a single facility. So I think that's mostly on the energy side. The growth rate of these cloud services is going way, way, way up. And as more and more of the first world and the developing world is starting to have access to these kind of devices, the default settings for many of these devices are to use these kinds of services. And most of them are immediately giving you 10 or 20 or 50 gigabytes of file storage to do this. And that's a number that is going to escalate very rapidly. This could be 5% of, you know, global electricity use in a short period of time.
Is there a certain company that an individual could choose that would guarantee that they would be using less energy?
I don't think that is really possible to figure out. I think most of the data center companies and most of the companies making these services are using basically the same technologies, and they're hiring the same experts to help them build them. The kinds of things that a consumer could do is to figure out whether the electricity sources and the impacts of those electricity sources at different providers might be different. But then again, the companies aren't really making that easy to figure out either.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
That was the Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray speaking with Carnegie Mellon University professor Scott Matthews about the opportunities and limitations we all have when we're trying to save energy used to fuel our online lives. To revisit our recent feature report about what data centers locally are doing to try to save energy, please go to AlleghenyFront.org. Cyber technologies that we rely on are something that the Amish do without in their traditional way of life. But some Amish are saying yes to one very modern, very industrial technology, fracking. In Ohio, some of the best pockets of oil and gas in the East run right under Amish country. The Allegheny Front's Reed Fraser found that the drilling boom is already changing the way Amish there live.
It's an overcast day in Carroll County, Ohio, in the southeast corner of the state. An Amish man, dark wide-brimmed hat, long beard, buttonless overcoat, is at work on his hillside farm. He mans the seat of what he calls his hired hand. It's a skid steer loader, a kind of mini bulldozer he uses to haul huge piles of feed corn around his dairy farm. He was able to buy the machine with a new source of money, royalties. He leased his land for drilling a few years ago. He only got $15 an acre back then. But 2 years ago, Chesapeake Energy drilled a well on a neighbor's farm. At around 7,000 feet down, the drill bit turned sideways and went underneath his farm. It followed an oil and gas-rich rock called the Utica Shale. Soon after, this man began receiving royalties. He won't say how much. The farmer, following the beliefs of most Amish, wouldn't allow his name or voice to be heard on the radio. But off tape, he said he saw no problem leasing his land for drilling. In his slightly German-sounding English, he says, the land was made for people to use. Many of his Amish neighbors feel the same way and have leased their land for drilling. Rigs continue to migrate into this rural county. It's got the most drilling permits of any county in Ohio. Every day, it seems, more and more trucks hauling sand, water, and equipment crowd into the streets of the county seat, Carrollton. It's music to the ears of Amy Rutledge. She's the director of the county's Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau. It's been good for her, personally. She was working part-time before the drilling started in 2011. Now she's full-time.
You see hope in people's eyes again, where it had gotten pretty depressed around here.
Rutledge has seen the small Amish community grow since it started coming here in the 1980s. Many had come from Geauga County, east of Cleveland, which had experienced rapid growth in that decade.
So they're moving to areas that are not quite as built up.
But in a twist of irony, these areas are now on top of some of the most lucrative rock formations in the East. One nearby well produced $30 million in oil and gas recently. To capture this bounty, companies like Chesapeake use hydraulic fracturing or fracking, a process in which millions of gallons of pressurized water, sand, and chemicals are forced down a well to break up the fuel-rich rock. This is a 24/7 industrial process in which thousands of trucks are needed to bring even one well into production. It might seem at odds with Amish life. The Amish came to this country beginning in the 18th century, and they abstained from the technologies that most Americans take for granted. But don't judge these people by their horse and buggy, says David McConnell. He's an anthropologist at Wooster College in Ohio who studied local Amish communities.
You know, we tend to idealize the Amish and see them as all natural and organic.
But that's just not the case.
They are not Luddites. They're not stuck in the past with respect to technology use. Rather, the Amish believe that any decision about technology needs to be balanced with a discussion about the impacts of those technologies on community life.
And sometimes that means embracing new technologies. That's why some Amish choose to plant genetically modified crops and use pesticides. Amish generally don't feel a need to preserve the environment for the environment's sake either. McConnell says this can be traced back to a basic tenet of Amish life, religion.
Most Amish would believe in a literal view of Genesis. They would believe that the earth was made by God and that humans have dominion over the earth.
And that the earth is there for the benefit of humans to use as they see fit. And the way that most Amish traditionally use the land is farming.
I guess 10 bales or 20, 10 or 20. Four bucks a pound and a three and a half.
At the Carroll County auction, Amish farmers mingle around huge stacks of hay that are getting sold off. The Amish here have almost all leased their land to oil and gas drillers. A young Amish carpenter says his father-in-law built a new barn with his lease money. With drilling come environmental concerns. Oil and gas operations have been linked to cases of groundwater contamination around the country, though the industry maintains that if it's done right, no harm will come to underground aquifers. I ask one Amish man if he's worried at all about his water. He says, "You worry about water, but what are we going to do about it?" He'd leased his land to Chesapeake and said he would take the company at its word, that if anything happened to his well, the company would come back in and fix it, or provide him with other sources of water. Among those milling about the auction was Kathy Garson.
Well, I came to look at hay, and I love to buy baby calves.
She's English. That's how the Amish refer to those outside their community. She lives in the nearby town of Sayo. She works at a grocery store and has been able to live a little more comfortably because of leases on her land. In conversations with her Amish neighbors, she's learned that oil and gas money has helped them out, too.
They're allowing this to go on because it benefits them, too. They have bills just like we do, and they've got mortgages, and they're paying their bills and farming with the money that they've received from the oil and gas business.
The Amish talk about not wanting to let the outside world in. That's why they live the way they do. But to keep that way of life, some are starting to let the energy industry, one very modern aspect of our outside world, onto their farms and into their communities. They're hoping it's a good gamble to take. In Carroll County, Ohio, I'm Reed Frazier.
Now, some other perspectives on farming and making ends meet. At the recent Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture Conference, the Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein asked growers, how do you define success for your farm, and what does money have to do with it?
Okay, I'm Don Kretschmann. The farm is Kretschmann Farm, and I've been farming for, 35 years, 40 years, something along that line. You know, and I think success would be to have made a difference in a positive way for the world going forward. That's a little bit better than it was when I got here.
My name is Tim Mounts, and I own Happy Cat Farm. It's always nice to pay the bills. It's a triple bottom line business, so people, planet, and profit. So we're looking at all three.
My name is Margaret Schloss. My farm's name is One Woman Farm, and it's located in Gibsonia, PA. Being preoccupied with money all the time is in a way that anyone wants to live their life. But, you know, I also measure my quality of life with the relationships I have with my customers and chefs, the relationships I have with apprentices, watching them blossom into really, really capable people. I get a lot of satisfaction out of those things. So not having a huge bank account, I think, is set off by those types of satisfactions.
My name is Betty Furtiver, and we have a farm in Valencia, Butler County. It's not a huge money-making venture for us. But we can sleep at night because we're happy with what we do and we're proud of what we do. So basically, we don't earn a lot of money, but if we break even, I'm very happy.
Okay, I'm Alan Matthews, and I've been farming in Washington County, Pennsylvania. I'm 63 years old. Success for us is going to be to break even every year. When people start thinking about economics, economics isn't just money, isn't just financial economics, it's the environmental economics. And so when you're farming sustainably and you start thinking about the environmental benefits that you're getting, that's another way to think about economics.
My name is Sandra K. Miller, and I own and operate Painted Hand Farm in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. I define success as being able to sell veal scallopini to a vegetarian. And you laugh, and I do it. I do it. It's great, because once I tell them that beef you are eating takes so much more energy and resources to get to a mature product, and I'm using a byproduct of the dairy industry. My idea of success is being able to keep a roof over my head, food on my table, pay my bills, and be happy.
My name is Georgia Ann Kowakowski. I'm from Three Cheers Farm, which is located in Putneyville Heights, Pennsylvania. For me, money isn't really the driving force. I want to really tread lightly, so I hardly try to buy anything. I don't have a big commercial interest in stuff, so I don't do stuff. But good food and good friendships are really where it's at.
Those were the voices of farmers gathered at the recent Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture Conference, recorded by the Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein. Hal couldn't resist listening to what comes out of the mouths of babes at the conference. He wanted to know what kids living on farms have to tell their peers in the suburbs and city.
Basically, I would tell them, be careful of the pigs because sometimes they can be very rough, and the chickens, they might peck you.
I would tell them that if they want to start one, it would be a good idea because they grow really healthy foods and they help people.
It's fun.
That animals aren't things that you throw around like balls.
That even if you don't live on a farm, you should still take care of everything.
It's a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work.
Well, that it's a lot of work.
It's lots of fun, it's lots of work, but there's also lots of room to run around.
You have to really like to be outside.
You better like getting messy because you're going to get really messy on a farm sometimes.
Farming is fun!
What would you say to being one with nature by sleeping outdoors in the winter? Most of us might turn that suggestion down. But for our high school intern and some other youngsters, winter camping is something to sing about.
It be cold and it be creepy, but it's still fun, like sleeping in a teepee. Word.
Winter camping, an essay. That's coming up on the Allegheny Front. Please stay tuned.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University, now celebrating 20 years of preparing environmental professionals. The center provides multidisciplinary education for careers in environmental science and management with opportunities for research and internships. Programs include a BS in environmental science, master's in environmental science and management, and professional certificate programs. More information on the Center for Environmental Research and Education at 412-396-4749 or duq.edu/ESM.
Federal budget cuts that went into effect this week are expected to bite into environmental programs. The Allegheny Front's Anne Murray's been looking into what's called sequestration. Hi, Anne.
Hey, Jennifer.
We are now seeing a drama out of Washington, a so-called budget sequestration, $85 billion in cuts, 7% across the board. What do these cuts mean for Pennsylvania's environmental programs?
It's a pretty sizable cut. The Obama administration estimates at least $7 million in environmental funding will be cut, and that's to ensure that the air and water quality are maintained and to prevent pollution from pesticides and hazardous waste.
There are smaller agencies like the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission that will also be affected.
Yeah, that's right. I think some of these smaller agencies are going to feel the pinch the most. I talked to John Arway, the head of Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission, and he says that the money that would be lost to his agency is actually state funding held by the federal government. Let's take a listen.
It's really state monies. It's an excise tax on either hunting or fishing equipment or boating equipment. And we believe it's unfair for the federal government to withhold that money from the states when indeed it really is the state's money.
That was John Arway, the head of Pennsylvania's Fish and Boat Commission. How would that money have been used?
To grow fish in hatcheries, to do habitat restoration and some other type of surveys. Arway does want to point out that he thinks the money will eventually come back to the state. He just doesn't know at what point. And their budget is so small, about $50 million, that it's tough for them to go ahead and plan without knowing where their money is coming from. He and other comparable agencies in other states are petitioning the federal government right now to make sure that the money comes back.
There's also Pennsylvania's Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. What's going on there?
Chris Novak, who's the spokesperson for Pennsylvania's DCNR, says that a 7% reduction in federal funds could translate to about $1 million decrease in federal grants awarded to the department. And she says that right now they don't think the impact would adversely affect their operations. It's a bigger agency, a bigger budget than Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission.
What's the picture like for New York or other states and federal parks around the country?
It's all proportional. As you said, it's across the board. If states have a bigger percentage of federal monies coming into their budget, they would be hit harder. New York, for example, twice as much could be lost or would be lost.
Compared to Pennsylvania,
about $14 million for environmental funds. And you're right, it is going to hit on a national level. National parks, for example, could be partially or fully closed. They could shorten operating hours. They can close facilities, reduce maintenance. And these would certainly all be impacting visitor services. And the reason is so much of their budget is devoted to employees. So as people have to be cut back and furloughed, that reduces services. And I think that this is one of the most tangible cuts for the American public because so many people go to national parks each year. It's about 280 million people.
There could be an impact, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council, on things like biofuel research.
Yeah, they have done a fairly long study over the last couple of months of sequestration. And one of the things they found is cuts to research and development programs at the Office of Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency could really hurt the creation of American technologies in wind and solar and biofuels. And we've talked about that. These alternative energies really don't have consistent support from the federal government. So this could be just one more thing, death by a thousand cuts.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and Department of Energy don't have good news for some of the employees in their purview.
Yeah, as we talked about just a minute ago with the National Park Service, so much of their budget is made up of employees. And they've already announced that furloughs in the agencies are inevitable. And they have said that they have taken early measures to cut back on agency spending on contracts and grants and administration. But all for naught because they do think that people are going to have to lose jobs, perhaps temporarily, but possibly longer.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Anne.
Thanks, Jennifer.
With the Allegheny Front's Anne Murray, I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. We've been talking about impacts of the federal budget sequestration on environmental programs locally and around the country. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. As we approach the official end of winter, Allegheny Front High School intern Charlene Ward knows that one of her favorite camping seasons is coming to a close. Now, if you would have told this city girl 3 years ago that she would enjoy hiking and sleeping outside in the winter, she would have called you crazy. But just listen to her now. This is her first ever radio story.
Before I joined the Student Conservation Association, I hated winter, hated being wet from the snow. When I found out that the Conservation Leadership Corps, a community division of the SCA, had its first trip in January 2011, I prepared for a long, painful experience. It was my first SCA trip ever, so I couldn't refuse to go. Instead, I went to Kmart and bought the heaviest, most insulated boots I could, and I packed a duffel bag full of clothes just in case I got wet. And I was still petrified. Apparently, this is pretty common. On a more recent trip, Wesley Smith said,
I keep hearing from people that it's not as bad as people would think, but in my mind, I'm still telling myself it's still a big thing, and I would need like a bunch of equipment.
At least 7 inches of snow fell on our first winter retreat. Luckily, we were staying in a cabin that time. Inside, it was cozy and we could hear the wind whipping against the chimes. But since SCA is a conservation organization, we couldn't stay inside. Our crew leaders dragged us outside almost the entire day. At first, I was miserable. Then I just looked around. I never realized how amazing the woods looked when completely covered in snow, or how remarkably peaceful it was just to sit by a frozen lake. The beauty made being cold so much more bearable. The crew spent much of the day hiking, snowball fighting, playing games, and setting up the campfire. I was having such a good time that I forgot how cold I was. The best part about the trip, and most of my winter trips, was the night hike. I recorded a group that went out in January. As the trudging through the snow started, what most were thinking about was returning to camp. You can hear our crew leader, Katie Horowitz, setting us straight.
Right now we're just going on a hike. I mean, I think we're going to start the fire right as soon as we get back.
The hike surprised me. I never thought I would find the dead silence of winter to be so relaxing. I felt alone with my thoughts. Another crew leader, Dan Malikoff, describes it like this.
What I really like about hiking in the winter is just the stillness of it. There's nothing that moves. You know, there's hardly any animals. When the wind blows, the leaves don't move. You know, and after a while, you really start to just feel very still yourself.
In the past few years, I've been winter camping 6 times, mostly with the Student Conservation Association. I've slept on the cold ground many times, and I have worked cutting trees, building trails, and doing other conservation projects in the cold for hours. I loved every minute of it. One of my favorite trips happened the same year I started. It was mid-March, though it felt more like January. The temperature remained around the teens all day, and the snow was about 8 inches deep. That night we crawled into the Adirondack shelters. Just imagine a small shack missing one of its walls. Ice and frozen mud surrounded the entrances. I won't lie and say that I wasn't freezing that night. My body was fairly warm, though my feet were completely numb. I didn't get the best sleep, but it felt pretty hardcore. I accomplished something most urban kids never will. Levon Ritter expressed this feeling in his own way.
Rapping in winter is hella tight. When it be all dark at night, it be cold and it be creepy, but it's still fun, like sleeping in a teepee. Word.
What was most gratifying to me about winter camping was that I spent more than 24 hours outside in the deep cold. This is an experience I can laugh about and share when I am older. Heck, I'm even doing it now. I'm thankful that I joined the Student Conservation Association every time I step outside on a cold and snowy winter day. And when I smell a fireplace or a fire pit in my urban neighborhood, it takes me back to the campfire.
That was Allegheny Front intern Charlene Ward, a student at City Charter High School in Pittsburgh, with her first commentary for our program. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Please follow us on Twitter at Allegheny Front and on our Facebook page. Visit our website as well, AlleghenyFront.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Janelle Pfeiffer is the production director and social media ninja. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments, the Remmel Foundation, administered by PNC Charitable Trusts, the Laurel Foundation, and the A.D. and J.W. Wilson Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation and the Curtis and Edith Munson Foundation support coverage of Marcellus Shale issues.